I think we should start, and if people come late, then they come late. This webinar and recording will hopefully be watched by many more later on. This was a bit short notice, of course, but so I'm very welcome. I'm very, very welcome to Pierre Dillenburg, our speaker today. He is one of the main figures, I would say, in research on computer-supported collaborative learning. He received his master's degree in psychopedagogical sciences, and before that, he was trained as a primary school teacher. And after the master, and in this master's degree, he earned at the University Mont Hainaut in Belgium still, and then he received a PhD in computer science. So he changed domains completely from the Department of Computing at the University of Lancaster with the title Human Computer Collaborative Learning under the direction of John Self. So Pierre is now a professor of learning technologies at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, or EPFL, in Lausanne. Pierre was also a professor in Geneva before. He directed several labs, and currently he's directing the Chile lab on computer-human interaction in the area of learning and instruction. I think we will have the opportunity to talk much more about the different things that Pierre is currently doing research on. He's one of the past president. I think he was the second president of the International Society of the Learning Sciences, and he covers various domains of computer-supported collaborative learning, ranging from novel interfaces for face-to-face collaboration with tangibles and what he calls paper computing. Maybe he speaks about that as well. Two more cognitive projects. For example, he is one of the, well, maybe inventors together with his group of a dual eye tracking, so having two physiological measures with eye tracking in parallel to analyze collaborative learning. His lab conducts projects in elementary schools and also in vocational education and university teaching, so primary, secondary, and also tertiary or university vocational education as well. He's currently very much engaged in research on MOOCs, but we will maybe also have the opportunity to discuss about this later. So the plan would be that Pierre will talk a little bit more about the paper that we sent around, Computer-Supported Collaborative Learning, the basics, emphasize maybe a couple of points that he thinks are important to be aware of. And then there would be opportunities for you, for all of us, to ask questions and for discussion. And I would have a couple of interview questions then later on. The whole thing will be recorded, so everyone who does not want to be on a video that is then publicly on the web later on should somehow sit somewhere and not to be in the focus of the camera. Okay. Pierre, the stage is yours. Thanks for coming, and we look forward to your talk.
Okay, good evening, everybody. To start with, maybe just a reminder that when you ask a question, before to push the button stop broadcasting, you have to wait for 1 second after the end of your question because the technology cuts the last second. And maybe also you can open the chat thumbnail at the bottom of your video. So good afternoon and welcome to my home. I decided to go home tonight, so this is my fire, my garden. Maybe I show you my nice, my nice kitchen and so on. The kids are upstairs. I hope I will be quiet. They will be quiet when I make this discussion with you. Everybody ready? Should I start? Okay, so maybe the best summary I can make of this paper is that over the last 20 years, the meaning of supported has changed. Computer supported collaborative learning. What does it mean, supported? Why do we believe that computers could in any way facilitate collaborative learning? So I can discriminate five stages in the evolution of the word supported. Are you still with me? There is absolutely no feedback. So maybe you can type things in the, I don't know, in the chat from time to time so that I see if there is somebody listening. Yes, thank you. Frank has made a smiley. Where's the smiley button? Oh yes, there it is. Okay, smiley. Oh yes, I see my smile. Okay. So the first meaning of computer-supported collaborative learning, supported means enabled. Basically, the very beginning, it was even called educational telematics. At the beginning, that there is a network connection and you can communicate with each other at distance. Okay, and then very quickly, there's been a new, from the very beginning of the 90s, there's been a new understanding, which is supported means design. It means that the way we design the communication tools between people will shape the way they interact. And therefore, it will shape the learning effects. So that was namely the work of Jeremy Rochelle on his envisioning machine. He wanted to design a nice graphical representation for the speed of particles. And in end of, he was looking for an unambiguous representation that he would call high epistemic fidelity. And he found out after a while that the best property of a visual representation of particles were not to be epistemically fidel, but to support interaction between two people. The property of the representation would be to help the two people talking to each other to disambiguate their conversation in order to build a shared understanding. So that was the idea. The cable is not just a cable to communicate. The cable by which you communicate between two people is supposed to shape, the way you will communicate. And so we had this more graphical interface like Belvedere and semi-structured interface where the chat will have predefined buttons like I agree, I disagree, and this button will influence will shape the way you will, the way the learners will collaborate. The third one was came from the physically from the weaknesses of the second one. Design is good, but it's not enough. Design is not strong enough to make sure that all teams interact in a way that we know is productive, like argue, disagree, explain, regulate each other. Design was a bit too soft, I would say, too homeopathic. There is notion of scripting. And Frank and his team in Munich, and well, it was in Tübingen for a while, and in Munich and back to, anyway. And my team, we started to invent different kind of script, which is some kind of scenario that you will follow when you collaborate. So typically in the work of Frank, to structure argumentation, having buttons that are pro and against will not be enough. Structuring means that we say, John, no, make an hypothesis. And then you say, Suzanne, no, please bring some counter evidence that John hypothesis is wrong. Then you say, John, now can you reject the data brought by Suzanne? So it will really be guiding the argumentation and between people. So it's a stronger guidance than just design. Design is kind of smooth, very cute, indirect guidance. Cute, but maybe not strong enough. While the scripting idea in phase three was stronger. We need to push a little bit, you know. It's here, you feel the Swiss-German influence where we're not afraid to be a bit directive with people. So actually my script were quite different from Frank in the way that I was not scripting only team activities, but what I call integrated learning scenario, which are scenarios in the classroom where there are some collaborative activities, but there are also some lectures. There are also some individual learning activities. I was a bit nervous in the beginning of this century that collaboration became too much a religion, that everything had to be collaborative learning. And this is, of course, wrong. There are some things you better learn alone, you know. Five times five is 25. We're not going to explain, to justify, or to argue a bit. It's just learn it, full stop. Some reflective activity have to be individual. Some writing, summarizing, reading. So not everything has to be collaborative. So in the script that we designed in my team, there was a mix of collaborative learning, individual learning, and class-wide activities. And but still, the idea was still that, for instance, we would. These activities will shape the way people collaborate. For instance, we will find people, if we want to have strong argumentation like Frank, we will find people in the class with opposite opinion and we'll pair them. So there was still the same goal of structuring collaboration. These scripts were quite nice, but they were not easy to manage. If you are a teacher in a real classroom and you have to jump between individual activities, class activities, and so on, you have what we call a strong orchestration load. Orchestration means managing in real time multiple activities located at different planes, individual, team, class, and you know, coping with all unexpected things that occur in a lesson, everything that can happen that doesn't work as expected, all the external events, the fact that some students are late, some students missed the previous class or cannot understand. It's managing in real time class. And we sometimes design technologies that spoil the life of teacher, which makes their life too difficult. And so orchestration came with a slightly new focus of, I call it classroom usability, you know. How do we consider in the design of the technologies, not only the collaboration, but all the ecosystem of the classroom, and how do we make teachers' life more easier, you know. One of my nice example is we have this very nice interactive simulation with a tangible interface, and it's so engaging that the kids, they play, and they never reflect. So you can play with the simulation as long as you want. If the teacher does not force you to reflect and analyze what you have done, you will never learn. So we had to give a tool for the teacher to stop, to block the simulation on this very cute interface, and we call that orchestration card. The teacher has some card that he could show to any of these interactive devices, and they will freeze, and the kids will not be able to run the simulation without the teacher coming back. And the teacher will come back, and they will have to explain what they learn or what they will do. And so what did I call what? My orchestration cards? It's just tricks that we give to the teacher because our technology was, you know, making his life more difficult, and in the sense that we needed to give him more control of the class so that he could say to the students, before to run the simulation, you need to express an hypothesis And the control of this before, do I make sure, was done by this object. So this phase of CSCL, I would say, is to put CSCL, just a second. Hey! So just a second, sorry. That's real life. Sorry about that. Somebody bringing something. Okay, and I was saying that it's let's say considering CSCL not as a standalone activity, but as an activity which is part of a global context in the physical classroom, not especially online, in the physical classroom, and trying to minimize the orchestration load. And finally, I will. There is something more recent that started 1 year ago, which is these famous MOOCs. And MOOCs so far have, I would say, almost nothing to do with CSCL. And that's a challenge for a community. So what the kind of learning activity that we see in MOOCs is a bit rudimentary compared to what we know in learning sciences, in the sense that basically the first thing is lecturing, and lecturing is not the most effective learning teaching method. So this is not exactly true when we see what's happening in the MOOCs. So my university, BFL, has been pushing strongly the MOOCs in Europe. We got 265,000 online students in 1 year. And when you look closely at what they do, they spend 1 hour or two on the video, then 5 hours or six on the assignment. So it's still, we overestimate the role of videos in MOOCs. The main learning activity is still solving problems, doing the assignments. But there is no much argumentation activities and so on. And how do you scale? If we have the nice script that Frank Fischer has developed, that we have developed, we run them in classes with 20 kids. How do we scale them up? Or can we run that with 20,000? That's not yet in CSCL, and I think it's a mistake. CSCL is left over. We should have a learning science is left over from the MOOCs, and many of my colleagues are extremely critical. I say MOOCs are bad because it's a very conservative pedagogy, and so we have to stay outside. My attitude is just the other way around. If we stay outside, we will not influence the evolution of MOOCs. We can be critical, but inside, and that's the strategy I follow. And so to finish, I developed a theory of scale in MOOCs, how we scale very rich learning activities with 20,000 students. I developed a formal model of that, and I finished the last draft last week. So I'm working on that, and that will come hopefully quite soon. So that was my summary of this 25 last year of my life. I think I should stop here and ask Frank what should come next.
Thanks, Pierre. I would think we should open the floor to any questions of the participants. So if there is any comment or questions on this overview of the last 25 years, that would be the right point in time. And until they get ready to ask questions, my question would be, how can we imagine rich learning activities with 20,000 learners? So what type of theory is that we can expect? So starting from the the last step in that, or the most recent step in this history overview that you gave. So what, how can we imagine a theory that enables or that should facilitate rich learning activities with 20,000 learners?
Well, it's a graph theory where you have MOOCs modeled as geometric weighted graphs, which graph with properties where there is a weight attached to each of the edges of the graph. And the geometry, it's a geometric graph because it's the geometry that I described this individual team class. And then there are three more layers in the geometry. And basically, this graph has kind of formal properties. So let's take the example of one script. I don't know if it is described in the paper that I've mentioned many times, ArgoGraph. So you find people with opposite opinion in a class and you ask them, or do you find them because you give them a questionnaire. Based on this questionnaire, you find people with opposite opinions, and then you form groups, which you form pairs of people with two opposite opinions, and you ask them to answer the same questionnaire again. So it works with 20 people with the technology that we developed. There is no reason why it should not work with 20,000. Same for the jigsaw. You take, you define roles, four roles in a team. You give to each team member data in such a way that the team cannot solve the problem without involving the data from all team members. This is a very old collaboration script, and this can be scaled as well. It just has to be formalized and to be integrated in a workflow. So what is a workflow? It doesn't sound as a very pedagogical stuff, but it is very pedagogical. Like a workflow is a sequence of, on this graph, basically the edge between activities, collect data from one activity and reuse data from the next activity, and apply operators in between. So between two activities, there are some operators, and there is a long set of operators, aggregation operators, distribution operators. So aggregation operators, you aggregate data from one level to the next level. Distribution, you do the opposite. And social operators, you form teams based on some criteria. And why is this a pedagogical concept and not just a technical concept? Is because the way you will distribute data to a team will determine the cognitive process of the team. So if you give the same data to each team member, you will increase consensus building, if which in some cases good. If you give complementary data, you will have the jigsaw method. If you give conflicting data, you will have the argumentation method. So by changing these operators in the workflow, which sounds like very boring technical bureaucratic details, you actually decide what will be the cognitive process and the social interaction of the learners in the next activity. So how do you scale up rich learning activities? By formalizing them and representing as a graph, and this graph is able to generate a workflow. And that's the first part of the theory. The second part is that if from the beginning you formalize the graph, analytics will be more powerful. It's the idea that we design for analytics so that we don't wait for the MOOCs to be completed before we say, okay, now we are going to analyze the data, but that from the beginning, a formal description will multiply the power of the machine learning method that you can apply after a while. That's the two ideas of this theory of MOOCs that I've been developing over the last months.
Thanks, Pierre. So maybe also, as I know that some of our participants are quite, let's say, freshmen in the on the PhD level, One thing that is also in your paper is the aspect of the media effectiveness. And I think that's quite, it's a kind of reflex, let's say, of anyone starting to work on technology-enhanced learning to think about what effects can technology have. So what is the effect of computers? What is the effect of mobile learning? And now what is the effect of MOOCs? So you are arguing that this might be the wrong questions. Could you explain that a little bit more? So why is the effectiveness question with respect to technology, why might that be the wrong question? Or is it the wrong question?
What is the effect of wine? Well, it depends if you drink one glass of five bottles. It depends if you take a very Grand Cru Classé, one of the top wine, or if you take this ugly wine in front that they have in plastic bottle. So what is the effect of learning with a simulation? Well, it depends, a good simulation provide learning gains, but you can have a bad simulation. What is the effect of learning with a MOOC? It depends. You have a terrible MOOC where the structure of the lectures are bad, the assignments are not interesting, and you can have a fantastic MOOC. So it's not per se because you make a simulation, a micro world, a hypertext, a CSCL environment, or a MOOC that will be good or not. It's just like the quality of wine. It's not given. It's like the quality of teachers. You say teachers are good. No, they are fantastic teachers. I love them. There are many bad teachers. I hate them. And there is a quotient between the two. So. The belief that because we MOOCify the class, it will have intrinsic effect. No, it has potential effect, what we call affordances. And the question is whether in the design of this MOOC, this micro world, this simulation, we really exploit this potential effect, we exploit these affordances. And I remember a nice experience where we use a hypertext. It was indeed most of the people here were not born, so it was late 80s. It was a hypertext, and so the teacher uses hypertext in two classes, two half classes actually, but he gave the different instruction to the learners, and in one case, very precise question about which information they should find in the hypertext. And maybe people don't know what is hypertext. That was the way we call the web before the web. It was the way we could navigate in a hypertext before there was the World Wide Web was invented. So the same hypertext used in two half classes with different instruction. In one case, find some precise information. In the second case, explore a domain. Completely different navigation pattern, of course, and hence learning gains. So even the same tool in two different contexts has not the same effectiveness. So, speaking about the effects of a technology is an overgeneralization.
Okay, thanks. There is another argument in that text. Maybe we highlight that a little bit more. I mean, another kind of reflex, if people start to work on collaborative, computer-supported collaborative learning and computer-mediated learning, I think is that we should have technologies that enable collaboration in a way and interaction in a way that it is most similar as possible to a face-to-face interaction. And you said, well, this is not always making a lot of sense. So what is the main argument here? Why is that the case? But maybe also Susan has a question in that area.
Do you want to come? I don't have a question. Oh, yeah, it's you. Yeah. Here's our person is coming.
Hi. So I wanted to ask a question based on your last comment, just as a follow-up. So do I hear you saying then that because it depends to a large extent on a number of factors, this notion of if teaching or learning with technology, how it becomes enacted is dependent on specific factors. So do I hear you say that one size does not fit all? And so then what are the tensions when we are thinking of scaling up, if that's the case?
Now you have to push the you need to push that
stop
green button to stop broadcasting.
Sorry.
There was two ideas. One is, first of all, it's the design. You can design a very good CSL or a very bad CSL. So it's not because you call it CSL, MOOC, or whatever, it will be good. So the first thing is that even before usage, a tool can be bad or well designed and or not. That's stupid to say, but it means that it's not because you say it's a MOOC that maybe you've seen that some MOOCs are terrible, you don't want to follow any of them. Second thing is that yes, when you run it, the effectiveness of the tool will also depend on the way it is orchestrated, managed, in the context it will use. The simplest example is the prerequisite, the same class, the same MOOC might completely fail because the students, in a new class, it has been used in a class, it worked well, you try with a new class. We know that 80% of failure is due to lack of prerequisites. So if the new class has not the same background as the first class, it will fail. So you are right. The point is the generalization, the scaling up. If you say, okay, this method works well, we proved in a field experiment that it works well, then we will use it in our educational system in USA, so all classes would try to do it. This generalization generally fails. I saw one nice example, the clickers, the peer instruction method. The professor lectures, it stops. He asks a question, the students have a clicker, remote control, they have 2 minutes to answer, and then the results appear on the PowerPoint of the professor, and then they have 3 more minutes to convince the neighbor, and we go on. Very effective method, many papers from Eric Mazur on the effectiveness of this method. Okay, should we scale it? Should we have all teachers in a university using the same method? I've seen two of them completely screwed with this method. They came in front of the large lecture theaters, 200 students, 300 students, and they asked bad question. So they were boring question. What is the definition of No, people, kids, the students don't want to say what is the definition of, they want to have question which challenging, if I increase alpha, would temperature increase or would the device explode? Or, you need to have good question. So the same method, it's stupid to say, but the peer instruction method is good with good question, but it's not good if the designer choose less interesting question, and choosing good question takes a lot of time. So if you are the Minister of Education and you say, okay, with robust evidence that peer instruction clickers are effective, I want to scale it up to generalize it in my country, there are many chances that it will not work because many teachers who don't like this method will be forced to use it, so they will not invent smart questions and so on and so on. That is a dramatic aspect of education, is that from a success story in learning science that is published in top conference, and we prove with all the rigorous data that this method is effective, it won't be a guarantee that it can be applied in all schools of a country or something like that. Should I get back to Frank's question or?
Yes, would be great. So the question again, Why shouldn't we design computers in a way that they support that they support interaction and computer-mediated interaction in a way that is most close to or closest possible to face-to-face interaction? So because that for some seems quite natural. And my follow-up question, of course, would be: if you have a computer-supported or computer-mediated interaction, then, and this is also what you are writing about, automated analysis is possible. So maybe you could speak a little bit about the possibilities, but also the frontiers that we face there with automatic analysis of this interaction.
Well, first, Frank, I have to tell you that we wrote that. So you are co-author on this paper, so it's not that I wrote that, but we wrote that. My favorite example is that planes are inspired by birds, and but yet they don't flip their wings. So you don't have, you know, planes that flip their wings like that. So the way that you do an artifact can be inspired by nature, but not necessarily imitated. Actually, I gave a talk on that, and then I received a video from participants about there is actually one plane that flies like that. But anyway, so here is an example. At the beginning of chat systems, especially what's called Moose, it was chat with a metaphor, special metaphor. I'm just reading the chat. Maybe I come back to this design package later on. Because, you know, why is reciprocal teaching not used in any country? That's a good question, except in some labs over there. But let's get back to the planes that do not flip their wing. So chat system. When the chat system came in the beginning of the 90s, I showed them to some of my friends, Michael Baker and David Schwarm, who come from linguistics. And the first reaction was, it doesn't work at all, you know, because in a chat, the turn taking is completely mixed. So I can say, Frank, what time is it? And then Suzanne, do you like wine? And Naxin, do you ski? And then I get yes, no, yes. Oh, nine, no, yes, and in a disorder. So in a face-to-face communication, that doesn't work. In a chat, that's not a problem at all. We have this mixed chat conversation with several turns are mixed. The regularity of turn-taking in a chat is extremely low, and yet it works very fine, very well. So the first thing they said, okay, now we will force turn-taking in a chat. And you will have to have threads and so on. And it was a catastrophe. Okay. So a chat system is different from a face-to-face dialogue. And it has different properties, like why can we have mixed turn-taking? Because you have the chat history. So the chat history is an extension of your working memory. So if you don't remember that you asked this question to John, this question to Suzanne, it's difficult to remember in your head if you are in an audio conversation, but with a chat history, that's not a problem you can see easily. So it's a different system. And if we try to imitate face-to-face with a chat, we make it a chat system worse. So it's a different system with different features. And certainly we cannot prevent ourselves to do that. Like this morning we had a lab meeting and last semester for the MOOCs, we organized team watching. So we suggest to the students, which are the local students, not the online student, but the local students, why don't you watch MOOCs together? So we put five students together in a room. We try different players. We invented different kind of team players. And there was no significant difference between the team players. Basically, the students love watching MOOCs together. You know, because these MOOCs are very difficult, and it's easier to suffer together than to suffer alone. We are social animals, so we are continuing to develop team players for MOOCs. And of course came the idea that there could be some teams which are not in the same room, but they are online and they still want to watch MOOCs together. And quite quickly, you know, even if I wrote this paper, quite quickly, the natural thinking that we have is, what can we give online teams if they want to match together that would be similar to face-to-face teams? And that's the wrong way. We can only fail. An online team will not be like a face-to-face team. It has the things that we lose, but there are also things that we gain. And if we try to imitate, we don't take advantage of the specificity of online, and we don't manage to be as good as face-to-face. So we are somewhere in the between, and it is worse. And I think it's kind of accepted in human-computer interaction that trying to imitate face-to-face meeting in online meetings is not a good idea. We have to reinvent new features in online interaction that do not imitate, but are functionally equivalent to the features of or are functional alternatives to what we have in face-to-face meetings. Now, I don't remember the second part of your question.
It was about the automated analysis, but maybe that was a paragraph that I wrote. But anyway, you could talk also a bit about you designed tables that indicated or that served or were able to serve as a kind of awareness tool for the whole team. So can you talk a little bit about the automated analysis of interaction and which roads to take there? What would you think are promising roads, and what would be, well, a bit too challenging at the moment? What are the limits currently of these automated analysis of interaction?
Okay, there are two lines for the analysis of interaction. One is the high road, I would say. You, for instance, collect what Caroline Rosé did. You collect verbal interaction of good teams and bad teams, or of constructive utterance and non-constructive utterance, something like that, positive and negative example. And you feed a machine learning algorithm, and you try to basically associate utterances or small episodes of conversation to some categories. So basically, you ask a human person to code by hand, let's say the categories of each utterance, and then you feed this data in a supervised learning algorithm, and you try to learn these categories. Caroline Rosé had some success with small samples. But as we know today, machine learning became extremely powerful, but with large samples. So now with MOOCs, we have this possibility to have more data, and that's why analytics are promising. I'm not so optimistic, but analytics for MOOCs are quite promising. That's one road. To have a smart analysis of the behavioral data of users. And then there is something else, the low road, which is, some people call it social signal processing, is to analyze not behavior, but behavioral dust. You know, when you type an answer or an utterance in a chat, the behavioral activity of the learner is the utterance that you will analyze, as I just explained. But there's some behavioral data, the typing speed, the typing pattern, the response time, the gaze traces where you look at, the mouse movement. And there is a lot of neglected data that we don't call behavior. It's kind of meaningless behavior, it's sub-behavior, is why I call it behavior dust. And that can be analyzed as well. And they are below the semantic level. So that's what we do with eye tracking. And we find out that if you take a pair, the most effective pairs, so we coded this pair by hand using the collaboration quality. Yes, thank you, Frank. Sorry for my accent. So we take pairs, we analyze them, we use a coding scheme from Anna Meyer and Anne Spada and Nicole Rummel. So into pairs that collaborate well and not well. And there is a strong difference of gaze patterns. Basically, when two pairs collaborate well, they tend to look at the same thing at the same time. And for instance, they are reading Java code together, and if they are not cognitively aligned, they are not talking about the same, they believe they talk about the same thing, but they are not looking at the same object on the screen. While the best pairs tend to look at the same thing at the same time. Actually, it's a complex thing because it's never the same pixel. So what do we mean by the same thing? And it's not at the same time. I look at something, then I mention it, then my partner hear what I said and he look at it. There is more or less 2 seconds distance between my gaze and his gaze. So it's a complex data, but it was quite funny to discover that without understanding what people say, without any semantic, we could predict the quality of teamwork based on gaze data. And in the other example that you mentioned, Frank, there is something even simpler. There is a table with microphone in the middle, and the table knows who is speaking because of the orientation of the voice. And in the table, you have LEDs. And LEDs, I don't know what you say, legs or whatever. And the more you speak, the more the LEDs in front of you turn in such a way that at some point it become, if you speak more than everybody else, it became publicly visible because your territory on the table increased that you speak too much. Very stupid, no semantic. You know, the more you speak, so what? Is that good for learning? You know, users are not so stupid. So people usually when they sit on the table, they say, Pierre, what happens if I say blah, 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 blah? I say, well, try it. Then they say blah, 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 and the table reacts. So the table become change color in front of them. And then they say, but Pierre, this table is stupid. I say, exactly, which makes them quite happy because they're a bit fed up with smart technologies. But basically, without any semantic, it was not analytics in the sense that we would predict the quality of a team, but by showing to a team how much each individual speaks, we fostered regulation. So in about two-thirds of the subject, those who speak too much speak a bit less, those who spoke not enough speak a bit more. One-third said, I don't care. So it's also another approach where what I call it the low road to interaction analysis. The high road is is use analytics, the computer do analytics in such a way that a scientist would do. And the second approach is kind of, there may be other ways to collect information from the behavior of learners, which is not this semantically rich analysis, which is to collect sub-behavioral information that in the first level you would say this is not interesting, but actually it occurs to be rather predictive of team collaboration quality.
Well, thanks, Pierre. Question directly following up. I'm going through my interview questions and the doctoral students might jump in at some point. During the last CCL conferences, several participants had the impression, me included, that maybe our questions are too specific. Because many people, policymakers, educational designers, they need other types of knowledge to design for collaborative learning in the classroom. Your example now is that although you ask very specific questions with your dual eye tracking and with your behavioral data, you still answer the question, what is team effectiveness, or what are predictors for team effectiveness? But what do you think about the CSTL research as we do it currently? And for example, this question with respect to collaborative problem-solving skills and computer-supported collaborative problem-solving skills, as it is analyzed in PISA and so on. It should be analyzed in PISA. Could you speak a little bit about that? Are we too specific in CSTL research, focusing on argumentation, shared knowledge, awareness, where others are interested in global teams supported by technology and how they develop competencies?
Yeah, I think CSTL is too small, too narrow, and learning science is the same. Learning science and both communities are a bit similar, like very high quality. I would say when it's a pleasure to go to this conference, because the people that you meet are rather smart, rather interdisciplinary, so they have you have computer scientists with a good understanding of education and people from education psychology with a rather good understanding of computer science. So they are good conference, and that's a trap, because they live a bit by themselves, you know, without any impact on the society. So that was my point about MOOCs. You know, no minister of education has heard about CSTL or script or whatever. They know all about MOOCs. All minister of education, even the mayor of Paris, say, I had to go for a conference in Paris. They asked me, you know, not the scientist, the mayor of Paris, what should we do about MOOCs? So it's not that I'm a fan of MOOCs. It's that sometimes a community should pay more attention to we are scientists, we have a little toy and we play in a lab, and some of us, you know, some of the people in CSTL, they analyze one pair for 12 minutes and they write three papers on that, and it's a bit of a selfish game. So this will change, because PISA 2015 will be on collaborative learning. I'm in the committee that has been desperately trying to influence the design of this test. But if it's not bad, it's not dramatic if the design of the test is a bit below the state of the art on CSTL. You know, when you do a PISA international comparison, you need to invent items that can be translated in 30 languages that make sense. You know, if you say, oh, this is a task where the kids have organized a trip to the zoo, and then the delegate from Korea would say, oh, there is no zoo in my country, you know. And so you abandon this item. So it's difficult to make a test. But even if the test is far from being perfect at the end, PISA 2015 will be about collaborative problem solving. So in every country which is not happy of its rankings after that, the Minister of Education will call you and say, are you in CSTL? Okay, our country was bad in the rankings of PISA. Can you help us to get better score at PISA? So this is why it's good to have this PISA stuff. So Shanghai, I'm sure that Shanghai, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Finland, the four Olympic champions of PISA studies, are already preparing for collaboration skills. But all the countries which will not score in the top five will decide to give more importance to collaboration in schools. Not to collaborative learning, maybe, but just collaboration in schools. And it will be like MOOCs, there will be many overstatements. Okay, we have to live with that. Scientists, my colleagues, scientists in many domains, are not scientists when they discuss education. They make overstatements all the time, anecdotes and so on. We have to live with that. But I think we have to be ready, the whole community has to be ready for that. Before 2015, actually, when the ministers will find out, will realize that the death is coming, there will be a momentum to integrate more collaboration in schools. And if we miss this momentum, we'll remain a little group of nice researchers, nice people that we meet every year, and without much impact on the society.
Hello together. I've got a question from Munich concerning the realization of the computer-supported collaborative learning. And you're writing about an environment that Hoppe and Plötzler developed for identifying individual skills of participants and reacting on that. And I wanted to know if this like really works out of a laboratory setting, and if so, how does the program assess the individual skills?
So that was 90-something. Huh? You know, I'm old guy and close to Alzheimer's. So I don't remember the details of their study, but so the kids, the students, they were teenagers, they go online, they have physics problems. And in some way, in the way they solve this physics problem, they could identify who had more quantitative knowledge, could had, they were very good at playing with the formulas, and but maybe they would apply the formula in the wrong way, but at least the mathematical, the purely mathematical aspect of physics was managed quite well, versus those who were good at the reasoning, so had more qualitative knowledge, but could not do the quantitative aspect correctly. So I don't remember exactly how they discriminated that, but you can imagine maybe. And based on that, they decided to match people with quantitative and qualitative knowledge, which was very original, because most of the jigsaw methods, you split knowledge into subset A and subset B. Now into this kind of complementarity was a really smart idea. And to answer your question, I don't think it never left. It was one prototype that they run. I think it was even before internet. It was on the local area network. And too bad, but no, it's something we could do in MOOCs. That's exactly, we have a physics 101 class started 3 weeks ago. And if we had a diagnosis activity where we can easily spot qualitative and quantitative, that could be automated, this automatic scaling. So the idea is more important than the technology they use at that time.
Okay. Maybe we switch a little bit. If there are no other questions with respect to the content on the main argument of the paper, I would switch to a bit more the political side of that all, so the society and so on, the Society of the Learning Sciences. Are there any more content-related questions or arguments, comments? Okay, this seems not to be the case. So you've been one of, I think, one of the first presidents of the International Society of the Learning Sciences. I thought you were the second. What do you think is the role of CCL in the Society of the Learning Sciences? And the other way around, what do you think is the role of the Society of the Learning Sciences for CCL?
I think I was the second. I think Chris Audley was the first president. But never mind. I was there because there was an interest to build a community that is a bit broader than a conference. So there was the Learning Science Conference, which was very American and still is. And there was a CSL conference, which was more international. And to pretend to make an international society of the learning science, they needed to have a European. And so having a guy with a strong French accent, that was very good for the branding of the society. It sounds much more international. So I was just an alibi to launch the learning science society. Now, the difference between the two is that I said CSCL is very European now. Actually, the Asian community in CSCL is very active. So CSCL is very a worldwide community where I would say there is an equilibrated strength in Asia, Europe, and USA, while the center of gravity of learning science is still in the States. But the idea was not learning science in CSCL. My idea was much broader. There is a variety of small, high-quality communities which are too small to survive. One is called AI and Ed, AI in education. Very good community, very interdisciplinary. One is called Educational Data Mining. Maybe it will not die because it's younger. One is called, there were many of them, the small communities and so on. And each of them, we have more or less the same problem, like we want to organize conference in a serious way. We want to get the money left from one conference to the next one. We have to want to have a serious journal. And the idea was to have a federation of small scientific communities on the bridge between learning and technology. It could have been many more. For me, the name should not be CSCL. Learning science is more general, but CSCL today doesn't mean anything anymore because it's difficult to imagine a learning technology that has not some collaboration in it. So, you know, it's not that CSCL is dead. If CSCL is ubiquitous, it's not a concept anymore. I think the first talk I gave on collaborative learning was, I don't know, 80, with computers was 89 or something, or 88. And at that time, people said, Pierre, you are crazy. You know, technology is for individualization. I mean, this is ridiculous to do collaborative learning. So at that time, there was a meaningful twist. Collaboration as a title. No, it seems so obvious, so ubiquitous, that I'm not sure the sense, the word CSCL still means something. So the idea was more to have an umbrella society that will help all the smaller society to live and to offload the management. So at some point we discussed the Red Sox Society. There was one name that came. So it will not belong to the people of learning science or to the people in CSCL or the people in AINet. It will be kind of a neutral ground. And but I was wrong. You know, people need flags. People need to identify themselves with something. So it's a human need. So you know, at the Olympics, there should be no flags. Why do people at the Olympics show flags of countries? Olympics, in the spirit of the Olympics, there should be no flags. It should be just the beauty of the performance and nothing else. But we are human beings. And, you know, when there is a Belgian or a Swiss guy, I change camps, who win gold medal, I still feel happy with that. So even though I think we should need no flags, I realize even myself, I need flags all the time. So CSCL become a flag, learning science a flag, and CSCL is more techie. And the key thing for me, for both CSCL and learning science, is to still manage to attract top computer scientists in the field. That's a challenge for us. And maybe I stop there.
Okay, so I mean, you already mentioned the aspect of computer science. You did your PhD in computer science. I also asked that Chris Hoadley, so what is the role of computer scientists? That is one thing that people complained at the last conferences, that computer scientists are not as present as they used to be in at these conferences of CCL and also the learning sciences. So what are the reasons, or is that true, and what are the reasons, and why do we need computer scientists?
Maybe it's because CCL belongs to learning science and not to ACM. You know, if there was an ACM logo on the CCL proceedings, we would have more computer scientists. The deeper reason is that if you send a paper without that is a great computer science contribution without any empirical study, you are rejected. And that's, I mean, this is an interdisciplinary field, so most good research should combine computer science contribution with empirical studies, but not all of them. And that's the second point. The third point is that computer scientists are confused with programmers. You know, computer scientist is not the guy who will write a program that you need for education research. That's not a computer scientist, it's a programmer. A computer scientist has to do contribution to computer science through the context of collaborative learning. So modeling, you know, computer science is about modeling things, and we can model collaborative learning, we can model interaction, we can model gaze patterns, we can model voice prosody during conflict. But we have computer science is about modeling things, not about fixing new windows when it crashed. So maybe I would say that the difficulty was to keep computer science issue in the field as valuable contribution to the field, and not only I need somebody to write the software for me.
Well, thanks. one thing that I mean, this is something I'm now asking for the PhD students. Well, last time with Chris Hoadley, we also have been discussing the question if learning sciences is a discipline. This is not a question that we should ask PhD students, I think. But related to this is, so I think CSCL is not a discipline, let's say. And so the question is, what do you recommend to young scholars, to young scientists, PhD students who are now working on CSCL related questions? If this is not a discipline, what should they do? Would you recommend them to establish or to establish themselves in their discipline in psychology, in computer science, and then have CSCL in addition? Or should they just present their work at CSCL conferences and be successful there, establish in that community?
Yeah, it has been a question all my life. I never know if I was a guy from education or from computer science. And I don't think, yes, CSCL can be an identity. It can be an identity, but it cannot be a career path. So it can be an identity during your PhD, but you have to anticipate that you will not become professor of CSCL. Okay, so you need to keep broad interest of what is going on in education if you want to end up professor of education in psychology or in computer science. You need to do both. You need to be narrow focused on CSCL. It's for me, it's a crossroads of discipline, but it's not one discipline. Say, well, you don't know. I don't think there is a good answer to that. I mean, if you take material sciences, is material sciences a discipline? Yeah, we have a school of material sciences. We have a master in material sciences. But at the same time, material science is a mixture of physics, chemistry, biochemistry, engineering, and computational modeling. So I think it's not the right question. I think the right question is, which kind of skills do you have to develop to become a top scientist in a few years? And I can only stress machine learning, you know, learn Markov models, Bayesian network, these new ways of modeling complex data that are not taught in education. And if you are from computer science, you probably learn it. But if you are from psychology and education, it's usually not taught there. And it's not that you have to contribute to machine learning, but I think it's the new, currently it's expected that everybody can do an ANOVA in our field as a basic culture of any scientist. And I think the next for education people is to be very at ease with these new machine learning methods. Better learn Markov. Sorry, I wanted to have a conclusion. Better learn Markov model than Vygotsky's model. It was just a joke about Russian people. So better learn Markov models rather than Vygotsky's model. I don't know if you managed to catch this. Frank, can I maybe continue on the evolution?
Yes, please.
I just wanted to have a comment. Remember I just want to repeat here a comment I made in the concluding session of the last CSL conference. There was a statement by Jerry Stoll saying that CSEL has escaped from rationalism and from counting things and so on. And I stood up and I mentioned what I want to repeat here, that there is nothing wrong in being rationalist. There is nothing wrong in counting things. It's not because we count something that this something is meaningful. Of course, we can count ridiculous data. Counting for counting is not the goal, but it's still part of the science endeavor to try to model phenomena and to have a rather rationalist. So especially I say that for the American people online, where there is maybe a too strong influence these days of this qualitative approaches. I'm not against qualitative. It's not qualitative which is bad per se. It's fuzzy or not fuzzy. Start your career by making formal things that can be very quantified. When you get old and Alzheimer like Frank and I, then we can move into blah blah, but don't move too early into this rhetoric approach to science.
So there seems not to be a direct response to that little provocation. Pierre, I thank you a lot. Maybe we have a quick round of comments by everyone as to what open questions are there, or what should be done in the future, what could be improved, and what development could be seen in CSEL in the years ahead of us. Would that make sense?
Hi. I have a very big question here that I pretty much made up of all the questions I had. Is it working okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the first thing is that I'm asking myself about, because everything like in the paper and for what you talk seems to work like pretty good and pretty okay, but I'm asking myself, what about differential learning? Because people has different ways to learn. So then you have like the computer day mediating, but is it enough? And then you have a lot of, you have a lot of other things like political implications, and I'm extremely interested in that because I come from a country in which, for instance, there's not enough, economy to support something like, so to say, courses for the professors or computers or all these kind of programs. So when you talk about these, you're talking like a big gap that comes also from the differential learning. You have different personalities, you have the bully, and then you have the maybe the child that is like the nerd of the class, and then the bully, if they are going to work together, maybe also by means of a computer, it might not work. Also, you said like, for instance, CSCL is going to be like ahead and more used, then countries like Latin American countries will get like more and more behind. And I'm really interested to know, first of all, how does the, this is like, I had several questions, I tried to make like a big one. But first of all, how do you see differential learning? Second of all, how does the CSCL works with different types of people, personalities, whatever? And third, the political implications for instance, third world countries or the new world countries.
Okay, so the first part of the question is actually an old question in education, to where this kind of findings, aptitude treatment, there is a T missing in the chat. Aptitude treatment interaction laws, the fact that the same pedagogical activity will not have the same effect on every learner. And there's been a lot of studies on that. You know, is a learner more visual or more auditive? Is he anxious? Not anxious, you know, inductive learning with anxious people is not so good. Is he field dependent or field dependent? There was very studied, useless studies, but very, very beautiful statistical analysis of the interaction effect between the feature of the learner and the treatment. A lot of research on that, even way before CSCL. And so there was a key idea of computers, we will adapt the instruction to the needs of each individual. So it means that if you are more visual, you will receive visual stimuli. If you are more anxious, you will receive a more deductive approach, and so on and so on. And then at some point, I think it's explained in the paper, at some point we had to put two kids per machine because there were more kids than machines. So we had to put a visual and an auditive guy probably together, an anxious and an unanxious. And so if you follow the idea of the aptitude treatment interaction laws, they should be less effective if you have two kids because you cannot adapt instruction to two kids which are different, and it occurred to be more effective. And this is all CSCL came, that maybe there is a benefit of adaptation to individual difference. But there is also another benefit to put people together with difference, people which are different, that you put them together. So basically, my My answer goes in two points. First point is that instead of having people receive personal instruction that correspond to their features, let's mix people with different features, and it brings a lot. The second thing is that most of this research is a bit useless, because what do you do if you have somebody who is visual, quite visual, moderately anxious, and very field dependent? Do you have a method for this guy? And there were other features. So it's useless to know that 2,000 different categories of learners, if basically you have only three methods. If you have only three methods, three variation of the same method, but you should only have three categories and not 2,000 categories. So there was a bit too sophistication in this research, probably because it was statistically very beautiful to show that, but pedagogically it's maybe not so meaningful. Basically, if you adapt instruction to the needs of prerequisites, to the level of prerequisites of the learner, you reduce the main part of the variance. So in all these individual features, I would really say let's focus on prerequisite. That will explain more the variance. So I would say no, don't try to adapt CSCL to all individual difference. People have tried that for 20 years without much result. Okay. And the second thing about developing countries, I really think that there are a lot of things coming in South America, where they distributed laptops to all kids in some countries. In Africa, it's a clear goal of my university, for instance, to do MOOCs in French, because there will be soon 600 million French-speaking people in Africa, and a lot of problems, bandwidth and so on. But for instance, we negotiate with phone operators with free bandwidth for education, not for the rest of the studies, but all the MOOCs. So I think it will be an opportunity for these countries. You know, if you are in Nigeria, there might be five kids who get a grant to go to MIT or EPFL. But there are still 50,000 that are very good students and who might access knowledge. So I think the technology might allow developing countries to catch up faster. And but this technology has to be improved, has to be, you know. So one of my colleagues, for instance, is developing a technology where you have four phones. Each of the phone download 1/4 of the video, and then so he pays only 1/4 of the price. And then you put them together, and by Bluetooth they share the rest of the video. So you download the full video for the price of 1/4 of the video. So this kind of technology is to be developed that will make access to online education worldwide. I don't know if you know the work of Miguel Nussbaum in Chile, where 50 kids in one class connected to one computer with 50 mouse and with very nice learning activities. So it makes me quite optimistic. Yeah, this activity works very well.
Okay, thanks, Pierre. So let's have a final quick round. University of Washington and also Naxin in Toronto, Fridays. And then I think we already have to close.
Okay, then let's start with saying goodbye. I think it was a great conference today, and maybe still many questions are left and will be discussed still in the group, and maybe we come up with some email, maybe hoping that you will answer it, but thank you very much, Pierre, for that conference. So, goodbye from Munich.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay, so Pierre, thanks a lot. Time's up. Was a very interesting presentation, and also I think interesting answers that will lead to some discussions at the different places. Maybe even more in the future. We have this video will be put online, and and all the other Naples programs and also other programs worldwide will have access to that, and maybe also to the paper, as you put it online on your page. I think we can link it, we can put a link to this page so that everyone has everything that is needed for understanding that session.
Well, it's okay for me if you put the video online, but I'm afraid that this is not the quality that people expect. I mean, the technical quality of the video, I don't know what you see, but when I see myself with bad reflection, bad light, not mentioning the people ringing the bell of the O's and so on, you know, the lesson of MOOCs is that we don't want Spielberg, we don't want with top quality of video, high resolution and so on, but still people expect good audio, at least good audio, and reasonably not too bad quality of the video. So maybe, I know it's just a discussion with you, Frank, that maybe for learning science, it might be not a good advertising to put low quality videos while the rest of the scientific community is putting online pretty good videos from the MOOCs. I don't know.
Well, you're right that the technical quality could be improved. I think also organization-wise, we are at the beginning rather than at the peak of what can be done. I think we will have different kinds of conversation later on, maybe a better technology as soon as we can afford it. But I think the quality, let's see what happens with respect. I think the quality is not too bad, but you're right, it's not great. So let me thank you, Pierre, and all. Yes, the quality of light. Maybe you would like to have the final words, Pierre, and then I think we close that session. Thank you.
Okay. This was not a CSCL experience. I was mostly speaking, so it shows that we have to improve. When we say, oh, we evolve technology for collaborative learning, we can see today that I had no visual feedback from you and so on. So it's better than just to read a paper. I think it's an improvement to be able to discuss a paper with the author, but still a lot of improvement possible for researchers in this field. So, continue to study this field. There is space for invention. And good night, or at least from my side, good night. On your side, have a nice day.